Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
There was a young rabbi who complained to his superior rabbi, saying, during the night, and during the hours in the day, when I devote myself to my studies, I feel life and light. But the moment that I stop studying, it's all gone. What shall I do? And this older rabbi said to him, that is just as when a man walks through the woods on a dark night, and for a time another man accompanies him who has a lamp. But at the crossroads they part, and the first must grope his way on alone. But if a man carries his own light with him, he need not be afraid of any darkness. So, now in the Hasidic tradition, and in the Buddhist tradition, in the Zen tradition, there is always this: be a light unto yourself. Now, in the Zen thing, which some people regard as a kind of a head trip, is very intellectual, mental, you know, and it is more mental than it is emotional. And after all, you know, in the Zen thing, there is the avatamsaka, you know, with the this tremendous analysis of things from which we have our, in this country, general semantics. There are intellectuals that turn to Zen. Orthodox Judaism we sometimes consider as being rather emotional this day and age. There's this weeping and there's wailing and, you know, at the wailing wall, and they're all standing there crying and beating on the wall and all this sort of thing, huh? And, you know, as so with the religions of the Middle East, they are an emotional people, you know. And I've told you before about this friend of mine that she went to, she was a German Jew. And she went to the Middle East, and she dressed as an Arab, and went to some of their religious services. And of course, for her, if she had been caught, you know, it would have been death. But she commented on the tremendous emotionalism of these people, and she would have been put to death because if she had been discovered because of the emotional fervor that was going on at the time, so that they hardly knew what they were doing. So there is, in this world, individuals, people who are very emotional, and there are people who are more intellectual. And both kinds of people, they begin to look around for a religious vehicle that will accommodate them. You know, Because there's nothing written in blood, you know, that says that you belong only to one faith forever and amen. Huh? You know, it's up to the individual to find the religion, that tradition or vehicle that is most suitable for them. Something that suits your mental capabilities and your emotional outlook. And one doesn't stay with something just because one is born into it. You know, if you're going to do that, why, it's like you cover yourself with a blanket. You smother yourself, maybe. Because if you're just accepting it because your parents were in it or something, how can you be yourself? You're covering yourself over with a doctrine that maybe you don't even understand and maybe have no desire to understand. It's just that you're there. And everyone should have religion in his or her life. Everyone should have a way into himself or herself. And that's religion. And now also in Christian Science, which is also regarded as a mental rather than emotional, you know, as in the Zen, which I've already explained. Zen is intellectual until you begin the meditation. Then emotion and intellect goes by the way. But in these groups, we find intellectually oriented people and a great number of Jewish people. I have read somewhere that in San Francisco, 50% of the Jewish people are in Zen. And in Los Angeles, 33% of the Jewish people are in Zen. Isn't that interesting? I mean, it's where they're not satisfied with what they have. They look around and into Zen. As I understand it, within the Jewish tradition, there is the Orthodox and the Hasidic. And in the Orthodox, we have the, my pronunciation of Hebrew words is pretty bad. It's as bad as it is my pronunciation of the Indian words, you know. The Ashkenazim, that's the German Jews, and the Sephardic are the Spanish Jews. So you would be out of the Ashkenazic, and you are also, okay? You're not from Spain or Portugal or anywhere around there, okay? And now, the Hasidic sect, it developed somewhere around between 300 B.C. and 175 B.C. And it came about because there were those who felt that the Hellenistic traditions were beginning to have too much influence over the Jewish people, and that they were turning from their own culture and from this rigidity in their beliefs that boom, 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 boom. And when Simon, you understand my, that's nice. When Simon the Just was high priest of Judea, the Jews became divided. Those who were for the very strict traditions and those who were for change. So we have what we call then the Orthodox and the Hasidic. And when Antiochus the IV, decreed that the Jews should eat the flesh of swine, it was the Hasidic sect, because they became the rigid ones, you know, and they were not for any change. It was this group of people that led the resistance. Death rather than violate any law. And then things went along until about the 18th century. And a new kind of Hasidim came about. And this was led by a man named Baal Shem Tov, which means something like the good master of the divine name. And it started in Eastern and Central Europe. And the living, the intellectuals living in that day, mostly the German Jews, were opposed to this new view, calling it emotional. You see, the thing just switched around altogether. And that the common man then would no longer come to the rabbi for the interpretation of the Talmud, that they were going to find it in themselves. This is what they were after. And this new Hasidic faith stressed meditation. Prayer and meditation, and their meditation was on not. And, you know, and they what they were looking for, somebody said, was a kind of a Jewish Satori. And so they had this thing that they now favored joy. Joy should be in your life, in contrast to that, you know, all that agonizing history that had gone on before, all this sadness and all this sorrow. Now it should be joy. Everybody, you know, have joy, be joyous. And they said, if you don't get any joy out of this life, how can you expect any happiness in the next? So have a joy. Okay? The joy and the laughter and the humor and the being what you are. This was then the new, the Hasidic. And Martin Buber, his attitude toward the Orthodox Judaism was that he found no joy in its very severe outlook, its the unbending dogmas. And he objected to the mechanical rituals. So this mystical Hasidim excited him. Hasidim, you know, by the way, was originally Hasidian, which means pious. Hasidian. Now, in this new attitude, it was said that everyone has the opportunity to become a silken man. Everyone has the opportunity to be learned, to be godly, to be virtuous. And they called that the silken man. And the dreams of these people at that time in Europe was to establish the kingdom of heaven actually, practically, they said, on this earth, not just in heaven. Not only that, it was to be, always to be soon, to be yet in my time. It was to be. And in order to hasten this day, you know, self-afflictions were rejected. There was no need to suffer, they said. You know, penance was false. The world didn't have to be evil, and the flesh certainly wasn't wicked. You know, and the devil wasn't constant, which is in contradistinction to St. John of the Cross, who said these things were. The devil always was, the flesh is wicked, and the world is evil. And they said, no. After all, these people said, the devil is not Jewish. So it came about that the Hasidim came to be called Jewish Joy. See? It was a way that combined intent, and their word for it is Kavana, and it's spelled several ways. It's K-A-V-A-N-A, K-A-V-V-A-N-A, K-A-W-W-A-N-A, K-A-W-A-N-A. Kavana means intent, your intent about the thing. See, the intent of the meditation. And to be filled with love instead of fear. And they believe that there is a spiritual nature in all things. See? The human functions, you know, such as eating and drinking and bathing and sleeping and dancing and the act of love, all to be considered as most sublime action, because all is done in the service of the Lord. So they traded sorrow for joy. But the joy also required a trade. Now, because you have traded the sorrow for joy, you must now contribute to the world enthusiasm. Yeah? When you have received this joy, then the love, the compassion should flow back into the world toward all things. This is then the service. The kavana is the intent, and the service is avoda. Working for, in service to, giving love to the world, avoda. So they began to seek a higher destiny for themselves. And so it came to be called a kind of a kosher Zen. So we have Jewish joy and kosher Zen. Yeah. But it also, like Zen, no compromise. No compromise. That the sorrow and the pessimism that had attached itself to the Jews had to be left behind. You know, as one person said, I think it was Kaplan, I have only to open a book of Jewish history. What is called Jewish history is one long contemplation of Jewish misfortune. Yeah. So the Hasidics fled from this. They fled from pain and misfortune, and they wanted instead joy. So instead of now having this stress on performance, you know, how you do your rituals and what you say, and, you know, on a fixed form, you know, which is, after all, outwardly bent, you know, the Hasidic brought in this struggle for an inner life. And, you know, in this doctrine of kavana, the intent. And now it also means concentration, it means devotion, it means purpose, it means right spirit, it means pondering, and it means meditation, and it means mystery. Kavana. After all, they said, the foundation of all religious performance rests in the inner intent of the heart, the kavana. So today, in that group, I think it's rather small and select, you know, it has come to mean the emptying of one's heart and the emptying of one's mind of every care. It is so emptying yourself as if you were standing before Shekinah. And now, and this term Shekinah, it has different connotations according to who uses it. In the Kabbalistic system, you know, where you have the 22 paths and the 10 sephiroth and so on and so on, you know, it is a title that is applied to Malkut, Shekinah. To some Jewish people, it refers to the cloud of glory which rests on what they call the mercy seat of the Holy of Holies. That's Shekinah. And in the to the rabbis of Asia Minor, to them it is the veil of Ein Sof. You know, the endless and the absolute. You know, like a kind of a mula pakrit. You know, Pakrit being the mother, Mulab Pakrit being the great, great mother. And so this Shekinah then is the great, great mother. Here we are in the womb of mother, but supposing the consciousness turned and saw the other side of the gap, then you would see Shekinah. You would see Mula Pakrit. On this side, you see Pakrit. Yeah? So that an individual who is seeking this Shekinah should be in a state of reverence, this kavana. You know, at the beginning of meditation, and one shouldn't rush through it as if one were only glad to have it over with. You know, there should be this intent. And so they say, pray and meditate with kavana, this intent, this right intent. You're on the noble eightfold path, huh? Right intent. Yeah. And you're supposed to refrain from conversation for an hour before meditation. And of course, you refrain from conversation for an hour after meditation. So you don't fit. That hour should be filled with humility, with humbleness. I mean, you have been to the place of the Most High. You have, in that hour of meditation, taken your refuge. Yeah. So, now, when man, long time ago, for the first time a man ever said, I, can you imagine how long ago that must have been? For the first time he ever said, I, there was a time when the word was not in the vocabulary at all, and he was being tribal. He would say, we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. You know, because whatever he did, the tribe did also, because he wasn't separate from it. And then out of that came me. The me and the we, you see. And finally came this I. But when he said I, coming out of this tribe, he found that he himself, not just the tribe, he himself suddenly had a past. Suddenly he had a history. And from this past, his own history, he found that he was headed into an unknown future. And somehow, in this headlong race that he was in, he found that this I gave him a continuum. Somehow or other, this I went on and on and on and on. And I wonder if man at that point, or man now even, or all the way between, you know, has ever involved himself in the question. I mean, not looking at it religiously, but just involved himself in the question of going from day to day. How? You know, how does this I go on and on and on and on? Of course, this day and age where the Western tradition has gone to the East and the Eastern tradition has come West, you know, we have taken upon ourselves the belief in reincarnation, that the body may die, will die, but somehow I remain. See, I am still going to continue. And forgetting that this I that we are usually acquainted with is an ego function, is connected with the psyche, which is the desire and form world, the kamarupa world, which does dissipate itself after a while, you know. But this moment to moment to moment to moment, how do I continue? Now that man that stepped out of this dark cave so long ago with this new word, this new term, I, and man today, you know, he still is groping along, trying to flow with his own nature. What he had to learn then and what he has to learn now is not to be frightened of himself. Not to be frightened of what he thinks, and not to be frightened of his own emotions. Tall order, isn't it? And now, not to be frightened of ourselves, we have to learn about ourselves. And meditation is the most simple way. Meditation is a groping within ourselves. It is an exploration to begin with. When we have this pratyahara state, it is an exploration of the emotions. It is an exploration of the thoughts. And then to go further than that and actually be in the meditation where there is this so-called groping, this attention goes beyond our daily world. We have insights of our personality, of our character. We can view the content of the psyche, and then to go deeper and deeper and deeper with this, what am I? What am I really? Who am I? Who am I really? Yeah. You know, it was Rabbi Zuzia who at one time said, in the world to come, I shall not be asked, why are you not Moses? God already has a Moses. I shall be asked, why were you not Zuzia? Why were you not yourself? we begin to look. I'm going to be myself. We begin to look for this self. And if all, and in all of this maze within that we come across, and then it comes the question, what self? Huh? The moody self? The thinking self? The greedy self? The giving self? Which one of these am I? Maybe none of these. Then who are you? You know, meditation is this process of digging into oneself, looking for this secret self. There is, you know, it's like a furtive, a little something that woos us, as it were. It beckons us like a kind of a will-o'-the-wisp, you know, like a little light that dances out there somewhere and says, come on, huh? And it peeks out now and then from behind something, you know. And when we go to grasp it, we find that it was not willing to be recognized. It's elusive. It avoids us. But somehow it's always present. Not quite available, but by golly, it's sure there. So, and we sit, and it is a method of taking off. It's like peeling an onion, one layer and one layer and one layer. And times can be a very painful defoliation, huh? Like the leaves in autumn falling from a tree, you know. And finally, you know, all the leaves are gone come winter time, and the tree stands there bare and naked like a Bodhi tree, huh? Yeah, in an empty sky. You know, Rilke said it, you know. Go out into the evening, leaving your room, of which you know each bit. Your house is the last before the infinite, whoever you are. Then with your eyes that wearily scarce lift themselves from the worn-out doorstone, slowly you raise a shadowy black tree and fix it on the sky, slender, alone. And du hast die Welt gemacht, and you have made the world. And it shall grow and ripen as the word unspoken still. When you have grasped its meaning with your will, then tenderly your eyes will let it go. And he called that initiation. Now, in the Hasidic tradition, as in Zen, it is said that meditation is more reasonable than holy. Do not regard meditation as something holy, even though you're taking refuge. It is a form, though, of using the mind and the body, the whole body, in a kind of an unspoken prayer. See, this is that kavana. In this meditation, God is not mentioned. God is not involved. You are after you. And it is in this, then, a state of letting go of everything that is not really you. The mind is emptied, the heart is emptied, and that which remains, awareness, Awareness has no barriers. And it then responds to the inner one who knows. Yeah. And now, when the positive individual begins to meditate or begins to pray, he starts with a word, Shema. Easier to say Shema. Shema. Huh? And it's in the book of Deuteronomy. Listen. Listen when you listen. Of course, in the newer versions of the Bible, they've changed that and they say, hearken diligently. But in the Jewish form, it is, listen. Will you listen? Listening can only be in silence. Silence of the mind. We do have a silence of communicating in which we listen to what the other one has to say. And if you're listening, your mind is out of the way so that you can listen. Even in communicating in conversation, if you're so busy with your own mind, you're not listening to the other person. And then there is just listening, which goes beyond all words and all communication. To be at Satori in Zen, is to be beyond words and any interpretations thereof. Satori has nothing to do with words. For as it is said, enlightenment is the moment of knowing without knowing and seeing without seeing, in which being is born. Now, there is nothing mysterious about meditation. No. It just simply goes beyond language. So it makes it seem obscure. The immensity The vastness, the immensity of Zen silence. It is so silent that it roars. It is deafening silent. And it was a Rabbi Nachman who said that when you totally give all of yourself, you become empty and silent. And when you become silent and empty, you become a vessel for the light. A cup. To be empty of your thoughts, to be in this silence. This is the knot, or the zero, the knot, the Hebraic ayin. And we have then out of that the service, the avoda, and the kavana, the intent. Like the zero or the knot of a mu. The little, everybody knows this, the little monk is walking with Joshu, and they're talking about that the Buddha nature is everywhere. And the little puppy dog runs along, and the little monk picks him up, and he says, does this dog have a Buddha nature? And Joshu says, moo. So this is this big koan, What is mu? This ayin of the Hasidim and the mu of Joshu are similar. And in Zen, we have what is called the great death, or the tai shi, where in this state, the ego is replaced by the true self, by being. And the concept of self-extinction in the Hasidic tradition are very similar, or at least this is what I'm told. Both deal with ego elimination. Both deal with what remains after every possible negation. So this Hasidic thing is seeking something more than how to be righteous and virtuous in this life. They're seeking for this higher spirituality. This joy that they keep coming back to all the time, you know. There is, at the end of their year, I understand, they have a big celebration. Samhat Torah. Come on, you Jewish people. There is the reading of the Bible. There's the first five books, Genesis, Exodus, Deuteronomy, whatever the other two are. And these five books are divided into 52 sections. And each one of these sections is read for a week. So that after 52, you come to the end of this book and you have this big celebration before you start in again. So, and it has to do with the Torah, which is the law, which is the teaching, which is the doctrine, which they feel is very similar to as the Zen Dharma. Anyway, at this celebration that they have, this Simhat Torah, everybody gets a scroll representing the Torah, and they have this, they dance around the synagogue. Everybody's full of joy, you know. It's a big celebration. And this one man went there, and he was very surprised that they did all this dancing around. They'd stop every once in a while, and they would drink wine or brandy. They'd take a sip. You've been to one of these? He's shaking his head, yeah. Okay, so everybody goes around dancing. And this man asks him, you know, you claim to be religious. What's with this drinking brandy, you know? And, no matter you feel good, you're... So this man answered him and he said, well, brandy brings joy, but it is the joy that is intoxicating. It's a funny thing, but in all religions, it seems to me, in a way, what people seem to be up against is anxiety. There's always something in there that tells you how to get out of a state of anxiety. You know, Buddha built his on this thing that everything is painful. Well, what else is anxiety except painful? Yeah, so here we have this. And and it is said that anxiety for a human being is as old as a human mind. And anxiety, according to Dogen, who was the founder of the Soto Zen sect. And he said, anxiety is necessary. Anxiety is a driving force toward enlightenment. Without it, as a kind of a spur, we're left to flounder in a very shallow, insecure life. Yeah. But anxiety, when accepted, and that's a big thing, when accepted, it works kind of like striking a match in the dark. You know, for a little moment, we have an insight. For a little moment, there's a little light. There's this flash. And this flash, then, he said, ignites our desire to break out of our shell. And one little insight, thus, one strike of a match, or the flint, one little flashes, you know, whets the appetite for more and more and more. Anyway, back to our story. The young rabbi complained to this rabbi of Rizin that during the hours when I devote myself to my studies, I feel life and light. But the moment I stop studying, it's all gone. What shall I do? And replied the rabbi, just as when a man walks through the woods on a dark night. For a time, another man accompanies him who has a lamp. But at the crossroads, they part, and the first man must grope his way alone. But if a man carries his own light with him, he need not be afraid of any darkness. So, you know, we could say, well, I meet you on the road. I have a lamp. Suddenly you're no more in the dark. And then we part, as part we must. I follow my way, you go on yours. You cannot depend on another's light. What to do? First, let the darkness be yours. Learn to grope. You will not fall. Our minds imitate. We borrow. 99.99% of the content of your psyche is borrowed. That much you imitate. But that which is most significant cannot be borrowed and cannot be imitated. You cannot enter the kingdom with borrowed money. You cannot bribe the guards. There are no guards to bribe. You cannot enter through a thief's door. There is no door. There is only what is called a gateless gate. You have to do the walking. But through your walking, it is your path. It is your way. Ready-made paths don't suffice. Borrowed paths will not let you through. You must walk your way. So you grope in the darkness, and you move within, and you will come finally to an inner, what was called an inner emptiness. It is a gap. This gap is necessary. It is not to be feared. You know, all this stuff about the abyss and blah, 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 blah. It is necessary and it is not to be feared. But you must realize that the old cannot enter into the new. You can't put new wine into old skins. The old man must be set aside for the new man, as St. Paul put it. And he said, I die daily. Every day I put on the new man and try to let go of the old man. But in front of this gap, all of a sudden, there is no continuity. The continuum suddenly comes to a halt. That's all that the gap is. You know, it's a discontinuity. There is a gap. There is a jump. There is a leap. And then the new man, the Son of God. This whole world need not be filled with light. Heaven, you know, on earth. It doesn't have to be for you to walk. Just your own heart. A little bitty flame. Little bitty flame. That's good enough to start, huh? Yeah. That little bitty flame puts out enough light so that you can see the path to take the next step. And no one walks more than one step at a time. Small flame in the heart. The small flame of awareness, of mindfulness, of meditation, and it lights your path. And then you walk, one step, one step, one step, one step, till you get to this gap, and then you take a leap. Over, out of the old. And into the new. You know, Lao Tzu said, by taking one step at a time, we can begin a journey of 10,000 miles. You can take the whole journey of 10,000 miles, one step, one step, one step. And you know something? God is not that far away. In the Isha, I told this is a potpourri. In the Isha Upanishad, we find this one unmoving that is swifter than mind, that the gods reach not, for it progresses ever in front. That standing passes beyond others as they run. In that, the master of life establishes the waters. That moves and that moves not. That is far, and the same is near. That is within all this, and that also is outside all this. But he who sees everywhere, the self, in all existences, and all existences in the self, shrinks not thereafter from aught. He in whom it is the self-being that has become all existences that are becomings, for he has the perfect knowledge. How shall he be deluded? Whence shall he have grief who sees everywhere sameness? It is he that has gone abroad. That which is bright, bodiless, without scar of imperfection, without sinew, pure, unpierced by evil. The seer, the thinker, the one who becomes everywhere, the self-existent, has ordered objects perfectly according to their nature from years sempiternal. Right this moment, what surrounds you? Right this moment, what beats within you? Right this moment, what is talking? Right this moment, what is listening? God is everywhere. It is he that has gone abroad. Somewhere a tree, somewhere a flower, somewhere a river, somewhere a bird, somewhere a rock, somewhere you and somewhere me. Religion is a revelation. It is insight. Religion isn't a desire to do better and be something, you know. It is a reality. Just turn a little. Why wait? For whom? For what are you waiting? For what are you waiting? You are the way. You are the light. Light up your path. Lighten up. Let us not forget ever. We are endowed with a very rare and a very precious consciousness. This is your opportunity to know it of itself. Why wait? That's my mishmash for the day. And now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.